Welcome to Keep the Hotel Empty. Today we've kept the hotel empty for representatives of the Sarasota Youth Opera, Jesse Martins, music director, Cameron, youth operator coordinator, and Martha Collins. You are the stage director and education director.
I am indeed.
Welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Wonderful to be here. Thank
this
you.
Is the first time we've had a trio, so forgive me if I seem overwhelmed or I don't know where to go. We're gonna wing this one the best as we always
well,
do.
Well, we're used to doing this and throwing off ideas of with each other when we're organizing and planning. So this is old home for us.
Okay, so. Very cool. So you guys are more used to being an entity.
Yes.
Wonderful. So I usually like to press rewind and try to find out where everybody started, but I really kind of want to start maybe at the meat and potatoes and work my way back a little bit.
Okay.
Jesse, I want to ask you first, what does the Sarasota Youth Opera mean to you, and why is it that of all of the things that you could do and have done, mm-hmm. you end up here?
Well, for me, the Youth Opera is a wonderful way to be introduced to opera, really, which some people think it's this highbrow thing, but, you know, when you get kids ages 8 to 18 and you put an opera together and they're on stage doing it, I think it breaks a lot of the preconceived ideas about opera. And primarily, I think it's because it teaches them so much about growing up and about working together to accomplish a common goal. So I think that is very special, but also, I am very passionate about opera, and I think that's a great combination for me to be able to work with youth and see them shine on stage in an art form that some people think is not for children. So,
what do you think contributes to that? Why do you think people think that opera isn't for children?
Well, I think, you know, opera has kind of fallen out of pop culture in the recent decades. As in the past, it was a little more present, so I think people feel a little more distance from it. And also some references to opera, you know, make fun of it or, you know, talk about length or some old-fashioned ideas about what opera is, you know. And in a way, opera, it's like musical theater in the sense that it's a story told through singing on stage, you know. Then when you get to the details of it, it's just a matter of style and, you know, a different style of music and some stories that are obviously different than musical theater. But in a way, it's almost like watching a foreign movie where,
right.
you know, it is being sung most likely in a foreign language, but you do have the help of super titles in the theater, so you're following the story along in English.
Okay.
So, you know, is the kind of thing that I think people are not aware of or some people are not aware of.
Yeah,
so they feel afraid of coming to the theater, I suppose. So.
What would you say, that's an interesting point you bring up there, what would you say is the big fork in the road between opera and musical theater? Because it seems like musical theater is something that the youth kind of gets into a little bit more easily, right?
I think it's exposure. I mean, the kids that come to the youth opera come to love opera naturally because
right.
it's such an amazing art form. And I think musical theater is an art form that has been adapted for children and they are exposed to it in school, which is kind of right there, right? So they don't have to go the extra mile to get involved with something like that. And it's part of American culture, right? So it's everywhere. And I think that contributes to that.
Right. And Martha, maybe this is a good question for you. I like to ask a lot of people, whether or not they're barbers or performers in some regard, what it means to them to be able to be exposed to this stuff early on in their education life. If that isn't happening traditionally here and culturally here, I guess for want of a better way of putting it, what are some of the things that you face in trying to educate people about what opera offers?
Well, like Jesse said, we face a preconceived stigma, right? In pop culture, often opera's the butt of the joke. It's the nerdy guy who goes to opera, or the serial killer who listens to opera.
Right.
Or they're making me go to the opera, it's so boring. And yet, we see time and again when we get students at the opera, they love it and they respond when we have, you know, a full house of students at our matinee for the youth opera, or they also come to the dress rehearsals. When they don't have a preconceived idea, they're drawn into these amazing theatrical, emotional stories that are told through the incredible beauty of the human voice. So if you're not limiting whether or not you're allowing yourself to enjoy that, like kids don't, they come and they gasp and they laugh and they love it. So that's thrilling to me, because I'm someone who started out in pop music and then started doing music theater, and people kept saying, you know, you might consider. And the first time I was around opera singers, I was awed, I was thrilled, I was captivated by the power of their voices. I felt my bones vibrating with this incredible sensation, and the depth of the music and the beauty of the music and the theatricality of the music.
Right.
I've always been someone who, whether I was walking down the street listening to music and imagining a story, I've always been drawn to stories, whether it was reading, theater. I want there to be a story in what I'm watching or taking in. And so opera is great stories. So to be able to be in a position where I'm passing on and sharing this art form I love with the next generations of audience who can potentially be just as thrilled and captivated as I am is a privilege and a joy, to see the light come into their eyes and the excitement grow in them.
Do you see anything beyond the storytelling nature of operas that make it so that it is universally appealing like that? So when these kids that are coming in to witness the shows, not necessarily perform them, that don't have preconceived notions, they end up in this state of awe, even though they might have been playing video games all night the night before. The rest of their life is not relative to being impacted by that.
Well, I remember, you know, playing my guitar. Guitar for me was only an accompaniment, because, again, I was about the storytelling of my songs. But when I first started listening to opera and the wealth of harmony and texture in the orchestra and the instruments and the variety of writing for the singers. I mean, a pop song that I was singing had I loved it. I still enjoy listening to it. But you know, it's a limited scope.
Right.
But opera singers are singing in three octaves and with this incredibly detailed, thrilling music. So there's so much more to take in as an audience member.
And I think there's also something to be said about the acoustic nature of opera.
Yes.
That you have a full orchestra of about 60 players at least, right? And you have these singers that at times are singing alone with this 60-member orchestra on stage, and they're able to cut through it with the richness of their voice, you know.
And no microphones.
No microphones.
Right? So there's an amazing acoustic that happens. Overtone series, short form, the orchestra maxes out at a lower hertz level, right? Then singers have an extra overtone series on their voice, properly produced classical singers, and that's why their voices cut out over an orchestra. So you can have a Wagner orchestra of 100 plus and a singer sailing out over that. That's thrilling. That's unique. That's magic.
Well, talk to me a little bit about how that skill gets developed, because just a little aside, though this has nothing to do with me, I've produced tens of thousands of hours of vocal sessions. So trying to get people to sing and project their voice and where to get them to sit so they can be heard over the band or whatever is a feat unto itself, with a microphone, with EQs, with compression. How is it that you can help somebody develop those types of skills to be able to sing out like that over such broad accompaniment? That is no small feat.
I think the interesting thing about singing and about the voice is that you know, if you look at other cultures where people have, you know, folk songs and they sing, you know, like you see in Africa, in South America, you know, the indigenous population, when you hear them singing, it's a very powerful kind of singing. And I think with classical singing, it's a little bit like that, in which we train people to really use the full capacity of their air, because really that's what supports a free sort of singing, which opera needs, right? The moment you have grabs over here and tension, the voice can't vibrate freely, you know. So I think it's a combination of what we as humans want to do naturally, right? Because if you have ever had a baby in your family, you know a baby can cry for hours without ever losing their voice, you know. And part of it is the breathing, and part of it is just, you know, instinctual sort of making loud sounds, which we can do. But I think with the digital aspect of music that is not opera, right, like that you have the help of the mic, little by little you use less of that. So I think it's different the way the voice develops for, let's say, jazz or pop singing, because you're always so close to a mic that subconsciously you're not going to use the full power of your voice, you know. And then sometimes singers that are only recording artists start doing a tour, and then right at the beginning of it, they lose their voice because they realize that, the energy you need to fill a stage, right, a theater live, it's very different than when you're in a studio recording. I think that's part of it. I know if you both have other to add to this in terms of
it's muscles.
It's muscle,
And you develop those muscles so that they can thrive and do what you ask of them. But I agree that it's not unnatural. It's a very natural physical muscular response to making sound. I mean, a baby, if they have to call their mom, like a little toddler in the next room, they automatically project their voice. It's on their diaphragm. So of course, you know, we're not yelling when we sing, but all of those muscles are ready to do that. So it's natural. So of course, young singers can develop their voices to be able to train them that way. Now, is a young voice as powerful as a professional opera singer? No, because there's more years of development of those muscles, but still, it started at a young age is fantastic because it puts them in a good place to continue growing that way.
Well, singing like that, and correct me if I'm wrong in this, or maybe elaborate a little bit, singing like that is a full body deal. This is not, you know, like you said, we're not grabbing a mic and yelling.
No. Actually, you wouldn't be able to do it, right? If you start yelling or something like that, the vocal folds would get swollen very quickly, and you wouldn't be able to phonate at a loud, you know.
It is still a wonderful mystery to me. I've studied all the science of it, but still that these tiny, tiny little vocal folds in your throat, and they're teeny tiny. When I was at university, I rigged the dentist mirror and flashlight so I could look at my own cords, trying desperately not to gag. But they're tiny. So that's still magical that those tiny little cords can fill an opera house and fill it in a thrilling, emotional, expressive way. It's not just sound, but the great opera singers use their voices to act. So with the colors of their voice, the nuance, the quiet, the loud, the more rich, the lighter, like all of the things that we do when we're speaking, you know, we use high notes, we use low notes, you know, whatever. But they do that with their voice to draw you in with the variety they use to bring their characters to life, not just physically, of course, that's part of it on stage, but with the sounds they make.
So do you think that the universal nature of that from a physiological standpoint is why you don't see opera with a microphone now? I mean, it's not like you can't have a microphone.
That's true, but I think, you know, obviously if you mix a digital sound with an acoustic sound, they resonate differently in the theater, right? So I suppose when you have an opera concert, for instance, outdoors in a open space like a park, everybody's mic'd, right? So you have some mics that are area mics in the orchestra to pick up the general orchestra, and then the singers have a mic that is obviously adjusted to an operatic sound.
But, yeah, right.
You know, I think that's part of the problem is that it's actually noticeable in the theater if you have a difference. If you have two sounds at the same time, the digital and the acoustic, I think that people can perceive that and they have different qualities to it, right? Because the moment you throw a acoustic sound through a digital mean, it will modify what Martha was talking a little earlier about, the harmonic parcels of the sound. That's what makes it rich.
Right.
You know, so the same way that if you listen to the same album at home and live, it's a completely different experience, right?
True.
So even though, you know, in pop music or commercial music, that live sound would still be digitalized, right? Because it goes through an amp and through a mic. It's a different experience for the listener because of the impact of sound that you get from live performance, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that's probably part of the reason. And I think a bit of it is choice, because obviously if you're going to do a classical concert with opera singers in a football stadium, it's going to be mic'd.
Right. Of course.
Because theaters are designed to project acoustic sound too, right? So
and resonate favorably.
And resonate, yeah, exactly.
But now I think all Broadway musicals, the it's all mic'd. I don't think there's any acoustic sound anymore in Broadway musicals, whereas they used to be in the times of Ethel Merman and all those people. They had to project and carry out over a band with no mics, right?
Right, exactly. And then we got the advent of boundary mics, and we all thought we were in heaven.
And now it's all body mics, right?
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Well, that actually brings up something that I didn't really necessarily intend on asking you guys about, but you may be good experts on this. You brought up some of the overtones in people's voices, the resonance of the room, the acoustic natures of things being palatable almost psychoacoustically to the listener. These are these are real things that we pick up on whether or not we're conscious of it.
Yes.
How do you feel about auto-tuned vocals?
That's probably part of the reason why they can't sing in tune anymore.
Well, just as an aside, and this is why I wanted to bring it up to you guys. You're probably all familiar with what frisson is, right?
Sorry, what is
frisson? When you get goosebumps from hearing music.
Oh yes, okay. Yes.
Frisson is the word, the scientific word for it.
In French, it's frisson.
Yeah, frisson. There you go. I'm Greek. I get
what?
A pass.
Me, pretentious.
So anyways, they've done quite a few studies on this, and they can't figure out why we do it, why some people experience it and some people don't. I have a working theory that an auto-tuned vocal is impossible to create frisson because, or frisson.
No, all good.
Because there's something tuned to us of the thousands of years we've been listening to each other and babies cry and being able to project our voices that in the back of our heads we pick up that's not a real voice.
You know, when I was at university a few years ago now, darling, one of the music theory experts had me sing for hours in a room. Emotionally, with emotion and without emotion, because he was trying to prove that there was a different measurable energy that went out to the house. Now, at the time, they did not have the gizmos to prove that. A while ago, I read an article, unfortunately, I didn't save it, but said that they now have measured that when someone sings with emotion, without emotion, there's a certain amount of energy goes out to the house. But when they are truly singing emotionally or embodying a character, there is a measurable difference. And I think that's what the frisson is.
And I think it's also, you know, because obviously sound is a wave, right? It's physics. It goes to us, through us. But also, if you think about the difference between the human voice and a cello or a violin or a clarinet or the drums, you know, but more the pitched instruments, they might be playing the same pitch, but the sound of the instrument, it's different because it has timbre, right? And that is also somewhat measurable, you know, it's physics, it's different properties of that sound wave. And I think, you know, obviously, that has nothing to do with acoustic or digital, but at the same time, if you think about music through, let's say, just the last century, you know, some could argue that it's gotten poorer in terms of that richness, you know,
right.
Back when, you know, every backing track was a full symphony orchestra playing, and now you have sampling of digital sounds, you know. Obviously, that has their own qualities, but when you think about the richness of the sound waves, like you're saying, like the in-person experience in the theater, like it's the combination of all of those things, right? Too, right? And like Martha's saying, the same voice, even if it's, you know, if you're talking with somebody and all of a sudden you're having a heated argument, the properties of the voice change, not only the pitch, but the inflection and where the voice goes and the amount of air you take in when you're about to say something, right, differently with a different emotion. So I think it's a combination of all of that. And unfortunately, you know, auto-tune kind of, it's the shortcut of shortcuts, but at the same time, it takes away that richness, which is probably how we perceive emotion as humans as well, you know?
Right, right.
The magic of live theater, right?
Yeah. Well, we've been tuned to listen to each other for a long time.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's such a pure way to do it, such an unspoiled way to do it. So, Cameron, I'm interested, where do you come into the fold?
I do a lot of the program administration for the Youth Opera program, and I help lead games and activities with all the kids, and I'm really there as a first line with them to connect with them, to help them through any difficulties they may be having, and connect with the parents to make sure they understand all that's going on with the Youth Opera program.
So were you part of the Youth Opera program, or you just came in to do this role?
I came in to do this role. I was a part of a musical program like this growing up, and I know the impact. It's what made me want to go into arts administration and work in arts education, because I know how powerful that is. So that's what I wanted to do. And when I found this position was here, it was a way for me to get involved with arts education in an amazing community like Sarasota, and especially at the opera, that would have a profound impact on so many kids. I love it.
And you did theater, like straight yeah. theater too, mm-hmm. right? Which is kind of live performance, but without the singing yeah. portion as well.
I was a musical
was
theater.
Oh, musical yeah. theater, but I know you were doing a play before you came down
yeah,
here,
so
right?
I was a musical theater major in college, so I did all cool. that, but learning opera is a whole new art form, and coming here, I was like, musical theater, opera, you know, it's similar,
we're
it'll
close.
Be fine,
yeah.
but it's a whole new world, and you discover that love for it. The first opera I saw here last year was Madame Butterfly. It was my first day. And there's a performance that night. So I went and sat down in the theater, and I did not know what I was getting into.
This was the first opera you'd seen, period?
No, not the first one I've seen here.
Okay, okay.
But, oh my gosh, it was like an explosion of everything that's wonderful about live performance all in one place. And from there, I'm like, not only am I honored to be involved in it, but I get to be a part of it and like help the kids out. And that's what makes it so special.
Yeah, very much so. I'm huge into arts for the youth. So talk to me a little bit about some of the things you noticed in the youth that when they get exposed to this, some changes they make or some light bulbs that go off.
Our kids come from everywhere and around the Gulf Coast, from up to Bradenton to down to Osprey and Venice. But when they come here, they create their own community. They're best friends with each other, no matter their age, their ethnicity, what they come from, what their voice types are. We have kids ranging from 7 to 18 in the program, and they really connect. And seeing kids connect in that way, where there's no pressure from outside sources or adults or pop culture, they are just able to be themselves.
Valuable.
And that's something that they don't get everywhere. In school, there's all this structure around them. There's peer pressure. But here we really encourage them to be themselves and to connect with all of their friends. And they do.
To be themselves, and that opera is, well, of course, I believe it's the greatest art form because it's all of the arts combining at a very high level. It's the visual arts, the orchestra, the singers, the set designer, costume designer, all those things. The libretto, the words are a poetic or prose work of art in its own right.
Right.
So it doesn't exist without massive collaboration. There's just so many elements and egos and ideas and creative thoughts that come from all of these different areas to create an opera. So we really try to make sure that the youth opera members are learning that. Mm-hmm. They're learning collaboration. But another goal, we love if we have singers go on to pursue music, but mm-hmm. we're always hoping that they're developing other skills like confidence.
Right.
Confidence. Getting out on stage, doing their part, feeling a part of this big whole and feeling that their input is valuable and vibrant. And I think it really, really builds something in them to go through that experience.
And I think it also, along those lines, you know, it's teaching them so much about how to work with people, you know, and also that it's not easy. You know, you gotta work hard and you gotta rehearse and you gotta rehearse it over and over again. And even though you rehearse all that time, things happen in live performance, right? So you have to learn how to deal with that as well, you know. And as Cameron was saying, you know, we have kids from, you know, second, third grade all the way to 12th grade. So they got to learn how to work together. And they don't get to do that in school. You know, it's very hierarchical. And, you know, if you're third grade, you are more mature than the second grader. So you look down on them, you know. Or you can't have friends from that grade because you're older, you know. So I think we provide an environment that allows them to work. And then, therefore, the older kids realize that they are kind of role models for the younger kids. The younger kids realize in the room they have to behave a little more maturely because they have the older kids there that they look up to, you know. So I think it's a great environment that it's very different than school. And it's a safe space for them to really, like Cameron was saying, let out who they are and figure that out for themselves, you know. So in the end of the day, even though, like Martha said, the goal of the program is not to necessarily train the next generation of opera singers, even though we're happy to do that. And if you're interested in doing that, we're able to provide you with the support you need, you know. But we are always happy to see that kids go into many different things in life. Youth opera, you know, alumni, and it's always wonderful to see where that takes them. And, you know, when we're able to talk with them sometimes, Martha has great stories about alumni because she's been with youth opera a little longer than us, of people that credit youth opera for learning some of the skills that were able to take them to the next level in their lives, whatever that career path was.
Right.
And it's the sweetest thing to meet the kids in prep, and they're down at your knee level, right? They're so teeny tiny, and to watch them grow into the performer who is taking center stage and doing it with confidence and power, and it's wonderful.
Yeah, what a valuable insight and valuable stage, no pun intended, because that's something that you don't. Not everybody gets a Ford. Athletics aren't necessarily going to do that. Even high academic achievements aren't going to do that. So it seems like you get quite a swath of people that come in, and then they invariably flower into quite a swath on the way out.
Yes.
tell me a little bit about who comes to you nowadays. You said, you know, I mean, opera has fallen out of favor in a pop cultural sense, but since it's universal and been around for so long, it's likely not going anywhere if it hasn't yet. So who are the people that come into your door, and what are they looking to do? Are they looking to build confidence? Are they looking to become opera singers? Or are they just kids that gotta have another extracurricular activity and this one worked?
Well, I think it depends what age they're starting, right?
Yes.
If it's the munchkins, it's the parents looking for something to expose them to. And then if it's older, sometimes we get kids who've seen a performance, they've seen one of the youth operas, and they think, wow, I want to do that. That looks so cool. Sometimes it's seeing an ad. Sometimes it's summer camp. We get a lot of kids who are interested in giving summer camp a try because it's 3 weeks, whatever, you know, it's
easy.
And then they fall in love with the fact that there's so many interesting elements to opera, right? They come from everywhere, right?
Literally everywhere. Sometimes the kids are really just looking for an after-school activity and they don't know what they're getting into. And sometimes parents see, it's like, oh, opera, that was cool, let me try it. And then the kids get here, and sometimes they are hesitant at first to jump in because it's scary to do something new.
And get loud in front of people.
Yes.
But all the positive feedback I've heard, it's amazing. There's this one boy who started this semester recently, and he didn't know what he was getting into. And his mom came up to me the other week and was like, thank you so much for allowing him to be in the program. His confidence has grown. He's made so many friends. Like, this program was a game changer for him. And they picked one of the programs out of the street, and they ended up here.
And word of parents is a big way we get kids, because parents talk to each other in parent forums and whatnot.
Sure.
And, you know, I'm happy to say that we get the feedback that we're offering the kids something they're not getting somewhere else, so that word of mouth is good between the parents. There was one girl whose mother dropped her off and said, okay, get out. You're going in there because she didn't tell her anything ahead of time. Because if she had said the word opera, the girl was, I'm not doing that. But the mother said, okay, go. You're signed up. Go. I'll talk to you at the end of the time. And she fell in love with it. She just thought, wow, this is fun. This is great. You know, so it's not going to be every child who falls in love with it.
Well,
because fortunately, there's choices in life. You know, someone it's going to be sports, someone it's going to be whatever. But we just love to keep getting the message out to families that this is maybe going to be the perfect option for your child.
And I think also the program, you know, caters to the different levels too, right? So if you have somebody who maybe they would never sing by themselves, they can still sing in a group setting, and little by little they realize that it's not as scary as they think. You know, I think we had a girl in the past who, you know, she really had this anxiety about singing by herself, but she had no problem singing with the group, you know, so, you know, and she had a good voice. So, you know, we said, why don't you audition for a role? You know, like Martha said, we do a youth opera production yearly, you know, and most of the roles on stage are sung by the youth in the program, you know, so you can work towards that level if you are really interested in the solo aspect of singing, you know, but we don't force anybody to do that. But she was interesting because she had no problems. But the moment you said, oh, audition alone, to sing alone, she would start shaking. She could not bring herself to do it, you know.
And yet she loved being there and being a part of it.
Yeah.
We are unique in North America in what we offer, that we have this year-long program, and each semester is a bit different, right? So summer camp, it's exploring everything that goes into opera. So props, costumes, singing, acting, comedy, acting, dance. We have a little bit of all of it. And then we do a fully professional opera production in the fall. So the same orchestra, costumes, sets, props, people that work, lighting, that work on our main stage operas, are working to give this incredible professional experience to the kids. And there are lots of companies that have a youth production, but it's not at this level of professionalism. So the kids really get to see how a professional opera goes together. That's a unique, rare experience.
What was the impetus to create that experience and not just be like everybody else?
Maestro De Renzi.
Yes, our artistic director, Maestro De Renzi, he helped create this program. Actually, this year is our 40th year. And
good
as the youth opera.
Yeah. Congratulations on that. That's no small feat.
No, and you know, part of the mission of the youth opera is to commission new works to be sung by youth. So that was a mission that was very close to his heart, and he's always been a big supporter and believer that opera companies should have a youth education, not only to lecture people about opera, but to give them the opportunity to do opera, which is a different experience, right? Like you can, you know, educate people or talk to people about opera all you want, but the experience of an audience member first is already what live theater is about. But then with kids, when they're not only experiencing it from an audience standpoint, but now they are the ones creating it, then it's personal and it's life-changing, right? But opera is an art form that requires mature voices, right? Professional adult singers. Even though lots of operas have children's chorus in it, they might have a solo role for a young child, you know. But the mission of the company to commission works allows us to foster new works that are tailored to young voices. So we're not making them sing beyond their means and therefore damaging their voice, for instance, right? So there's a lot that we are able to do by doing that, right? Advising the composers or the librettists in what stories are appealing to
youth.
Or appropriate, yes.
Both.
Both. But so we are unique in that sense that we've been around for a while, and it's always been important to Maestro De Renzi that this program exists and it provides them with a professional
and
experience.
And he had to fight for that. The first youth opera I did was in 2005, and we performed them in May. And in 2005 in May, you could walk down Main Street and you saw nobody. Sarasota was a very different place then. The demographics were different. The population was different. And
you're not kidding there.
Yeah, and there were a lot of our board members and donors who weren't around in May because our winter season was finished. It was January, February, March, right?
Right.
And so he had to fight to convince them that it was worth spending the money, because opera is not cheap. So it's really a commitment of the company to give this to the children of the community. And it wasn't until we switched our model and started doing our youth opera in the fall, and so then donors were there to see it.
Ah.
And the number of donors who came up to me and said, okay, I get it. I didn't get it before now. I get it. Seeing those kids up there having fun, being so expressive, working together, telling this wonderful, fantastical story that they're clearly so into, you know, so that was so rewarding for me, because, you know, up until that point, I confess, I didn't know that he was fighting to keep it going to a certain degree, not
right.
fighting.
Yeah, but,
I'm overstating
yeah, resist,
it, but
yes, yeah.
Yeah, that there was some resistance to the money going to the youth opera. So, and we're very fortunate that we have so many donors who really also value what this gives our kids.
Yeah, I guess talk to me a little bit about what the community means to the Sarasota Opera, because we do have, compared to a lot of places in the country, a relatively art-centric community.
Mm-hmm.
How does that change things for you from an operational standpoint, being that you do have some community support?
It's essential. Like Martha was saying, opera is a very expensive art form. Even, you know, though we do it in a festival format, the company itself is a full-time company.
What
right?
do you mean by a festival format?
Festival company means we do some opera in the fall and some opera in the winter as a festival. So in the winter, we have four operas, and they open one by one, but then they rotate. So we have four operas showing at the same time by the end of the season, right? Some opera companies.
It's a huge amount of scheduling.
I was
going to
say, that sounds like quite the undertaking.
Oh,
well,
yes,
and even backstage, having four sets or having costumes for four operas around. And
it's crazy.
Because you're doing four within a week or four within a day?
Well,
or
3 days sometimes.
Yeah, well, especially towards the end of the season, all four operas are open, and the last weekends are not included in the subscription series because we have all kinds of people who come from out of town to be able to see all four operas. So in those last two weekends, you see four operas. So they're switching over. It's different operas in the same day with a matinee and an evening. But I think it was last year we had people from 41 different countries come to Sarasota Opera to see our opera.
And almost all states as well, right?
So our aesthetic,
within a calendar year?
Yes,
within the
festival season.
Yes.
Good Lord.
So we bring a huge amount of tourist dollars to the community, because our aesthetic at the company is to do operas as the composers intended. So in many other opera companies, the aesthetic is to do something avant-garde or new or whatever, change the story. To be more contemporary. Sometimes it's to be more shocking or attention-getting. I mean, it depends on the situation or the director. But we believe that the stories are interesting and viable and thrilling as told through the composer's vision. So that's what our aesthetic is. And we have a lot of audience members from around the world who know that and who want that. They don't want, you know, a very avant-garde treatment of an opera they know and love. They want to see Puccini's La Bohème, Puccini's Tosca, Mozart's Figaro. They want that story. There's a reason these amazing operas have lasted for hundreds of years.
That's what
fantastic storytelling with fantastic music. I love Bizet's Carmen. I don't feel I need to make it Martha Collins's Carmen. I love Puccini's Bohème. So I think that's a reason that we draw so many people here to the company.
And that is a more uncommon way to approach it?
Yes, nowadays, yes. I think, again, there's people who believe the opposite of what we do, right? But I think, there was this idea back in the 80s that you had to modernize opera to appeal to a younger audience.
Ah.
So they had to see themselves on stage, otherwise they couldn't relate to the story, which I think is just somebody's opinion.
So they're modernizing it, and Marriage of Figaro is drug addicts under the Brooklyn Bridge. Obviously, I am not such a purist that I don't think you can modernize things. Of course you can. But only if you're still... The goal is still to tell an amazing story.
Yes.
As an audience member, if I'm looking, okay, there's three chairs hanging from the ceiling. Why are there three chairs hanging? Are they going to come down? Are they going to something going to open up out of,
Right.
And if those chairs are vital to the storytelling and make sense, and great. But I don't like operas where I feel, okay, this is this director's psychotherapy session.
True.
Or this director's ego. And it's not that I don't have an ego, but what I want is to be in a room where we all collaborate together to tell this amazing story.
And again, I think it's an assumption that was made, and people ran with it because also they could do very different things with it. But if you look at very popular movies or TV series, Downton Abbey or, Bridgerton or Game of Thrones. Like, these worlds is where opera lives too,
True.
Yes.
So there is no reason why young people can't connect with opera. Now, from working with youth, I can also tell you that if I dare to show them one of those productions where by changing it so much the story doesn't make sense and it's not emotionally impactful, they don't like it. You know what I mean? They react to it very negatively, even though those are kids who already know what opera is about. You know what I mean? So I think, like Martha said, is it possible to do Bohème in a more modern setting? Yes, you can, but you have to be very careful on how you treat that story, because that story lives in that universe. And by removing it from it, you are making it poorer. Or you're making,
changes better make sense, yes, and still move an audience, still engage their emotions and their imagination and their desire to come back.
Yes.
Right. Do you think that your goal of trying to maintain some of the traditional nature of these stories and the conveyance of these stories is what helps have opera as a format have this incredibly long past and potentially equally long future, that trying to contemporaneously make these things into these types of stories actually kind of makes it less impactful?
I think people go to the theater for stories, to be moved, to be engaged emotionally, right? To be drawn into this world. And if that's not happening, then I don't think they come back. And I think it's true if you're going to Shakespeare plays. It's true if you're going to, a strange treatment of My Fair Lady or something. So, and again, I've seen, very modern sets for Hamlet or King Lear or whatever on Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
But at the heart of it, they were telling that story emotionally and doing everything they could to make us understand those characters and their lives and their choices and their journey, right? To understand
from the essence of the original piece.
Exactly. Yes. So as long as whatever production it is doing that, as opposed to, there was a Nabucco, for example, in Europe, where Abigail, the main female character, is singing her heart out, some of the most challenging music ever written.
Mm-hmm.
And the male chorus around her are dressed as drone bees, and they're doing little dance. So to me, that's someone who doesn't believe that opera can be emotionally impactful.
Right.
That's the director who thinks, who doesn't know how to help that singer to be emotionally expressive and is just, they think opera's stupid, so let's make it be stupid. So, you know, that's the extreme to me, negative.
Right.
Modern interpretation and, you know, but.
Well, and again, I think obviously there's space for new works.
And, yes.
And I think in America, there's a lot of grants and foundations that do help new upcoming composers to produce new opera that is a contemporaneous story being told, you know, by somebody who's writing it right now. And I think that it's great and we should have a lot of that, you know. But like Martha said, I think if you are doing a detriment to the art form by changing something so much that it's not emotionally engaging, and, you know, then why are we doing it? You know what I mean? And like you said, I don't think it would survive 100 more years in this direction just because, like, if you come to the theater for the first time and you don't get the story unless you read this psychotherapy theory about whatever, you know, like
right.
they did the Carmen with the gorilla suit, that, you know, you had to have read this book to even get the concept of the production, you know, then you're going to you know, in a way, feel dumb. You're like, why am I here? You know, and why would I come back?
And why would I come back?
Yeah, I guess that's the biggest kink in the slinky. So let me ask you this. How prevalent is it for people to be trying to hone the skill to write new operas and not remake every opera? Is it sort of like we've kind of come to in the film world where we're just redoing all these movies because it's easier and people are familiar with it and we're putting a little spin on it, here we go. And then you've invariably made a more narrow lane for people to write new movies. Is that happening for people composing
operas? Like, the Met next year is premiering the new opera based on the movie Moonstruck. So I'm sure that is happening in opera, but there are a lot of new, original, creative works being written, particularly actually right now by the African American community, that since George Floyd, there has been, I think, an awareness of wanting to tell more stories from all different cultures.
Amen to that.
You know, so that's something that has really opened up in a different way, which is great.
So as long as there's a story to tell and that vehicle is there as a way to do it, we'll keep seeing that.
Yeah. I believe so, yeah.
So when you guys look to do a show, do you sit there and is the first decision we'll do an unknown show or we do something everybody's familiar with? Or how do you go about deciding?
Well, we're not involved. So some of this that we're talking about is not youth operas, right?
Yeah, right.
I mean, like Bohème and Carmen mentioning, that's all main stage operas. So, and we're not involved in picking the operas for the main stage. That's Meister Terenzi and Richard Russell. And as far as picking youth operas, as Maestro Jesse said, you know, we've had competitions in the past where we need a new youth opera, submit your suggestions, give us the first scene and your proposed story or this kind of thing. We also, you know, are always looking, who else is writing anything? Is there anything we can adapt?
Gotcha.
I love creating works with Jesse just because, you know, when you find someone that you think similarly theatrically and you can bounce ideas off.
What a gift.
You know, we're happy to have Cameron involved in the next creation so that, you know, we've written new librettos for things. We have another project coming up in the future. But then outside of that, you know, as Jesse said, there are grants or, you know, when will we have our next competition for someone to write specifically for us? I don't know. But the last one, Rutabaga Country, was really fun to work directly with the composer who was, she was composer librettist. Librettist means
lyricist,
write the story
essentially.
In the words, And so.
And that one we got through a competition model, right? So sometimes companies commission a work directly to a composer, and sometimes they put out a request for commission, which is kind of like a competition where you have finalists, and then the ones the company feels more drawn to is the winner, and then there's a collaboration to bring the work to life. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened with Rachel J. Peters and Rutabaga
Country. And it was really fun to say practical things like, okay, I've got a cast of 80 in this show to move around. I can't
literally?
Possibly.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
So our shows range from, say, 75 to, I've had 105 when we did Little Nemo's Slumberland.
Yeah.
But when we did Hobbit, I had to choreograph the fight of five armies with everyone with weapons, with an orchestra pit that they could fall into. Seth's so nodding. He remembers. So, it's big numbers. We're hoping next year when we do The Hobbit in the fall that we will have easily over 85 to 90 kids.
She means
that's what we're hoping
this fall.
For. Yes. This fall.
This is our next
2024.
Yes, 2024.
It's an amazing, fun experience. You get to be wargs and orcs and spiders and dwarves and tell this fun, fantastical story.
Well, I didn't realize it'd
opera.
Be that many people.
Yeah.
That's a feat unto itself.
It's a feat, yeah.
And we tell all three movies in one opera.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
In less than 18 hours?
Yes. In under two, actually. But it's a very dynamic work by Canadian composer Dean Bury. And Sarasota Youth Opera actually commissioned the orchestration of the work. He had originally written it for the Canadian Children's Opera Company back in 2004, just for piano, clarinet, and cello, I believe. It was a trio sort of orchestration. Mm-hmm. And when Sarasota Opera commissioned him to write the bigger orchestra for it, he went all out with it. I believe it's a minimum two percussionists, and they take the entire back of the orchestra pit with the amount of percussion instruments.
Very cool.
He scored for this. He loved finding all these different instruments to make, you know, the sounds in the cave with Gollum of the drips and whatever versus, you know, the weird sounds as the spiders come and attack, or the special effect whenever Bilbo disappears when he puts on the ring. Like he is a Tolkien fanatic. He taught himself Elvish, so for him, writing The Hobbit was definitely his.
So you got passion at the start of that
one. Yes.
Oh, yeah. And it'll trickle on down.
Yeah. And it's very creative how he's written it. Very creative, but also very smart because he was trying to give lots of special opportunity to lots of kids, which is what we try to do with every opera we create. If there's not enough roles, then we try and have some other way that we're giving lots of kids something special to do. Like with Little Sweep, we wrote this prologue and wrote a scene shift so everyone could have something special to do.
Very cool.
But so he was very sensitive to that. So there's 27 roles.
Yeah.
So reach out to the community. If you've got a child or if you're someone who would love to be out on that stage singing a role, putting together a character, projecting that out to an audience, it's a fantastic opportunity to come and shine. And if you're not someone who wants to do a lead role, you can be part of this amazing experience in the crowd being goblins and chasing. So,
so cool.
So,
well,
so
we'll
it
absolutely
really
have a link
offers
for that.
Both, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's very cool. It's very unique. You don't see there's, like I was saying before, it's not athletics. It's not, you know what I mean? It's somewhere where you get to incorporate a lot of self-discipline and creative freedom.
Yeah.
So, well, I want to press rewind a little bit. Mm-hmm. I want to start with you since you've been in the game the longest. Tell me about...
Darling, what do you mean?
He said you were here longer.
Okay, so we're not talking age.
No, we're not talking age. We're talking tenure.
Hey, and I've earned these wrinkles. So.
Yeah. And you had mentioned that you had played some songs growing up, playing guitar growing up. Talk to me a little bit about your musical journey and how you end up here.
So my mom would tell the story that she noticed when I started school more than the other kids because suddenly there was no singing around the house. So apparently I just sang nonstop. And music was my passion. I was doing pop music. I was Blowing in the Wind and Gordon Lightfoot and all that
of
stuff, right? And so I knew I wanted to go into music, but I hated singing in bars. I didn't want people to talk over me. I wanted them to listen to these stories that I was so drawn to, right? So I started doing music theater, as I said, and then switched to opera and fell in love, just fell in love with everything that opera offered. I just found it endlessly thrilling. And I pursued singing. I sang for a while. I did some wonderful gigs. And then I developed some bugs in my voice and took time off to work on them. And while I was doing that, a friend said, you know, this little company just lost their director. Do you want to give it a shot? And I had never thought about being a stage director. I'd never crossed my mind. I was always curious and fascinated with, you know, why did you put the blue gel in there? Well, why did you put the stairs on that side? So I was always asking all these different designers and creative people why they did what they did. But I was asking because how was it going to serve me when I was out on stage singing? I
You're
wasn't
right.
thinking. And so for the month of that first opera, I really did not sleep. I was so on fire because now as stage director, vicariously, I sing all the roles. I have to get into every one of those characters to really understand their motivation, how the whole story goes together. I get to work with all of these creative brains to plan all the visuals of the opera. I get to work with the conductor to plan. So it's a thrilling, endlessly inspiring, creative process to put an opera together. So I do think having been a singer informs what I do with the singers because it makes me understand much more of what they're going through so that when I'm working with them, you know, every singer, it's a little bit like a psychology thing, because this singer is confident, just needs an adjective. This singer needs me to demonstrate. This singer just needs some hand-holding. This singer, you know, so to try and read all of these artistic brains, and sometimes I'm good, sometimes I make mistakes, but that's the goal, to always make sure that as stage director, I'm responsible for everything the audience sees. So I have to work with all of those people to make sure that's all coming together.
So when you made the transition from wanting to be seen on the stage to yourself, from helping others be seen, other than finding out that you had to kind of be more psychologically aware of where these people are at, what were some of the new things you learned when you changed gears there? What were some of the challenges you faced when you changed gears?
Well, wanting to know more about all the technical aspects of theater. So that, yes, I'd always been curious, but that didn't mean I was super knowledgeable. So learning from all my different designers and hopefully trusting them that they knew what they were doing as I learned more about everything. So that was definitely a transition, but it was just exciting.
So the exciting smoothed over the other stuff?
It was so exciting it still tickles my funny bone that I never had planned to do it or envisioned myself doing it, and yet it was just like putting on the right shoes.
Yes. Amazing how that stuff works out. It's funny you should say that, because when people will tell me, you know, I worked a corporate job until I finally broke out and did my music, I always say, well, you were just wearing a pair of shoes that didn't fit. So Jesse, tell me a little bit about when you discovered the shoes that fit you.
Similar to Martha. I mean, I'm from Brazil. I grew up in Brazil, and I left the country after undergrad. So my family, we don't have a lot of musicians. And, you know, in Brazil, unfortunately, classical music is not as prominent, I would say, or as available. So I didn't grow up with classical music. But my mom noticed, my dad always listened to music and to a lot of different styles of music. He has a big record collection, and he would listen to it every lunchtime, because in Brazil, lunchtime, you go home, you know, to have lunch with your family. You have a bigger break in the middle of the day. So he would have lunch kind of quick and then listen to music. And I started around 9 years old, I started kind of going outside the room and listening to whatever he was listening to. And my mom noticed that. And that's when they kind of found a way of involving me with music through a choir. So when I was 10, I joined the choir. And soon after, the conductor said, you know, everybody should pick an instrument and study that because it will help with your singing.
Right.
So piano was the only one in the room. So I was like, I'll play that. Right. So
good choice.
My family was very supportive. They, you know, put me in piano lessons. Luckily, that choir had a conservatory. So I was able to do music theory and start piano right there, and I was already going there.
That young?
Yes. Yeah, I was 12 to 13 when I started piano, but
Which
is not young, yeah. But music theory kind of started straight away. It was kind of one of the requirements of the choir to do music theory.
See, and that's actually why I said that young, because in my world of musicians, lots of them have no music theory.
Yes.
And don't get music theory until they can already play.
Yes.
So because a lot of youth finds music theory really daunting, and it becomes this hurdle, I don't want to be a part of this if this is this seemingly anomalous.
Yeah.
But I think so, also when you are in an environment where you have your friends, because obviously, you know, my best friends became the other boys that were in the choir with me.
Right.
So the fact that you're together in the class, although it's challenging, to be honest, when you're 10-year-old to start music theory, I think we were together in that, so we would help each other. And also there were different ages, you know. So if somebody joined the choir at 10 or 14, they would go to the same music theory one, right?
Right.
So you kind of fostered these relationships with people that were older than you, and I think that also helped. But in any case, I kind of started piano, and to me the singing was secondary, meaning I really fell in love with piano, and that's what I ended up going to college for.
Awesome.
So my undergraduate is in piano performance, but at the same time, because of that conservatory, I feel, from the beginning, there was this collaboration aspect. So, you know, immediately after a year of piano, the conductor told me to start accompanying the choir. So, you know, it was a skill that I didn't know I was going to need later in life, and it also kind of made me fall in love with the collaboration aspect of music more than that, you know, solitary life of a solo performer, of having to, you know, practice 10 hours a day on her piano and then, you know, be always in a dressing room by yourself sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I had lots of friends who then picked different instruments to study. So I had lots of friends playing violin and the trumpet and the clarinet, and they needed a pianist to accompany their songs they were learning, you know. And because we were young and I was there for basically 7 years, you know, their music at the beginning was also easy. So for me, I could do it.
Yeah.
So little by little, you know, by the time I got to undergrad, I already had way more joy accompanying people and collaborating with different musicians than necessarily sitting at home and practicing piano on my own, you know. And my undergrad teacher recognized that and fostered that, because she understood that as a career path, I had way more options as a collaborative artist, as a pianist, than a solo artist, you know, because let's be honest, it's the 1% of solo artists in the classical world as a pianist.
At most.
Who will,
we're fighting for 1%.
Well, who will be at that level,
right,
let's be honest, and who will be able to make a career and pay the bills, you know. And to be very honest with you, like, my family supported me, but we don't swim in money, you know what I mean? Like, so the fact I was able to pay rent in undergrad by working with music, which was what I was studying, was very rewarding to me, that, you know, I was actually able to pay the bills by working with music and not necessarily having to choose other possible
work
career path or working in a cafe, which, you know, there's no shame in that. But to me, it just helped me develop my craft even further, you know.
Stay focused.
And at the same time, even then, you know, it was, I think, second year of undergrad when I found out singers needed accompanists too. Because up until then, although I accompanied the choir, you know, opera didn't exist in my radar. You know, it was not something I knew about, or I didn't know any opera singers. And all of a sudden, you had these students who were singing arias, and that was very fascinating to me, because, you know, I didn't speak any foreign language, and all of a sudden they were singing in Italian and all these different styles of music. And And that's when I started working with singers. And then once I started that, I ended up, you know, accompanying a teacher's studio who was still actively singing as an opera singer. Mm-hmm. And that's when I got exposed to, like, a whole opera. And I was like, wow, this is amazing, you know. So that I finished my undergrad in piano, and I ended up in New Zealand, actually, to study English.
Wow.
I know. It's a weird path. I wanted to come here to do a master's in what it's called collaborative piano, which basically is a degree that teaches pianists to work with other musicians, either instrumental or vocal. Sometimes you choose one, but most often you do both, right? And that did not exist in Brazil at the time.
I was going to say, how hyper-specified is that?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Europe has it, America has it, you know, but Brazil at the time did not. So I started really thinking about it. And to be honest, I mean, I did know of other people who had come here to do like piano degrees, like performance, you know. So that was my first goal. And then the financial market crashed and there were no scholarships, you know. And by chance, I had a friend who was, you know, living in New Zealand and working at a hotel, I believe at the time she was working at a hotel. And she said, well, you know, you want to do a master's in the U.S. and you don't speak English, so why don't you, like, come over here, maybe learn some English, you know. So that's what I did. At the time of my senior year, I was already working as a choir assistant at the university, and they had a symphony, and I was a keyboard player for the symphony. So I quit my job, saved some money, moved to New Zealand to study English and prepare to then come here to do a master's degree. Now, you know, by chance sometimes or by luck, I was very fortunate to come across an organization called Opera Factory in Auckland, New Zealand, that was a center for young singers, from kids all the way to undergrad, grad school, and professional singers that came together to put on a black box style operas in English.
What's a black box?
A black box theater. It's a smaller theater.
It's literally a black box. Yeah. The audience can be in many different
configurations. You know, the Urbanite here in town is a black box sort of theater.
Okay. Yeah. So I live right across the street from there, actually.
There you go. Smaller budget, simpler sets.
It was very community-oriented. Like, they, at the same time that they had these programs, they also basically accepted anybody in the community who auditioned to be in their productions. And then it was our job to teach them the music and teach them how to sing, sort of thing. And they sponsored my work visa to stay with them and work. So my 4-month stint became 2 years of working there as an assistant music director for this opera factory. And obviously it helped me greatly to then develop the skills that I needed to ultimately get my job at Sarasota Opera. But in between, I did go to Pennsylvania, Mansfield University, to do a collaborative master's degree in collaborative piano, which is how I got to the U.S.
That must have felt like a different universe.
Oh, very. Like, Mansfield it's a very rural Pennsylvania Amish sort of town.
Yeah, yeah. I'm familiar with that part of the country.
But,
for sure.
You know, it was a wonderful experience. And I got involved there with the choir as well. You know, they have a very strong concert choir. And through them, I ended up being able to go to the United Kingdom and do a competition with them, you know, Wales and Ireland and England. And that was a very awesome experience. But anyway, my journey kind of provided me then the tools and the resume I needed, even though I didn't know back then that's
right.
what I would need
right.
then to get the job I did with Sarasota Opera.
And that leads me to what I want to ask all three of you. How invaluable did you find it that either while you were a kid or now in hindsight, that you were able to start this education and get on this road so young before you even knew what it was going to be able to mean for you or what you were going to be able to parlay it into? And then how has that helped you now be doing this for the kids around you? Because inherently, I can more than surmise that's the goal.
Well, I think it's obviously in the moment, it's hard sometimes to accept where your life is taking you. But I think part of it is to obviously you got to accept what's going on, right? So I could have said, I could have been devastated and just like quit this idea of leaving Brazil, for instance, to pursue this other path, which seemed so out there, you know. And obviously, you know, my family had to make some sacrifices to make that happen, you know. So when it didn't, I could have, you know, just stayed and my life would have taken a completely different path, or got to New Zealand and like, no, I don't want to be here, or I finished my English school, let me go home, you know. So I think it's important to have goals, but it's also important to understand that if you don't go where you think you're going, there's still something to learn from that. And that if you're really passionate about something, it's worth pursuing, you know. And to be involved with it as a kid definitely deepens it. But I don't think it's a necessity, you know. I think there's no shame in recognizing maybe in undergrad that that's not the path you thought you wanted, you know. Like if it doesn't bring you joy at the end of the day, it won't bring you joy in the long run. You know what I mean? So
very true.
So sometimes the hard choices have to be made, but to your question, I think being exposed to it as a young person, it helps greatly, for sure, you know. And as we were saying before, it doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, being in music or theater or in anything that it's teaching you to work with other people and express yourself emotionally,
right,
will necessarily take you to that specific path, but I think it will help you, right? Because obviously we all have great memories of growing up, or things or friends we, you know, things we did or friends we made that are part of us no matter how old we get, right? So I think
amen to that.
These experiences, even more in this modern world where, you know, video games and being in social media and alone with a device is so prevalent, I think anything you can do that takes you out of that comfort zone is ultimately making you a better person, in the sense that you are getting more tools in your belt to deal with life, you know. So anyway, I'm very grateful that I was able to kind of stay in the music path and not really go away from it, you know. But, you know, some people would say that I did take a right turn, you know, from a beginning, you know, undergraduate piano performance to then end up, you know, working with kids and being an opera conductor, which, like Martha said, you know, as a coach, you work with a singer on a role and then they go off and they do the opera somewhere.
Right.
As a conductor, I'm able to bring everybody together, you know, and I think vicariously be all the singers at the same time.
So I guess then the operative million-dollar question to tie the whole thing together for you is, your exposure to it initially gave you the empowerment to roll with all the things and make it from Brazil to New Zealand and New Zealand to everywhere in between and back here. How do you translate that empowerment to the youth around you now?
Well, I think just, you know, believing in them, right? Because I think kids go through life a lot as they grow up with the no's, right? You can't do that. You shouldn't do that.
Ah.
And I think we are doing something that we can help them realize that they can do things. And I think some programs for kids, it's about telling them what to do and saying, you know, you're seven, therefore you have to do this, or you can only learn about this, right? Mm. And I think with what we do, it's about we together as a group of 70, 80 people have to work towards this one goal. And I think, you know, there's even studies of the grandma effect, right? If you put a kid that never worked in a computer in front of a computer by themselves, they'll figure it out.
Right.
But it will take them a long time. And if you have an adult behind them going, oh, you're doing good, you know, like, why didn't you try that? All of a sudden, they are able to do it much faster because they have somebody who is helping them believe or even work through the challenge of getting it wrong. You know, so I think that's the empowerment of my journey, is that, you know, I had people who believed in me be it from my family support, through New Zealand, through Mansfield, you know, every step of the way, there were people saying, you know, you can do it. You know, there's this path, but there's also that path, you know, or giving me advice on, you know, by this age, you should aim to have a full-time job in this area, you know. So things like that, I think, are very important, not only as a child, but as a young adult, because life is hard, you know, and sometimes...
It gets you comfortable yeah, being uncomfortable.
Exactly.
If you can practice.
So I am very grateful that I'm able to help other young people feel good about that. And so it's good.
Very cool. There's no reward bigger than that as far as I'm concerned. But, and talk to me a little bit about how your art came into your life and what made you passionate about trying to convey this into the youth.
I started performing in elementary school and just the school plays that you did. And there was one year I auditioned and I didn't get into the school play. And I was angry. I wanted to be a part of it so bad. So my mom took me to the local community theater and I auditioned there and I got in. And that's where I started fostering my love for arts. That community was amazing. I stayed with them all throughout middle school, through high school when I was able to. And that's what I mentioned earlier, found my love for arts and education and arts and children. And in high school, I co-founded a summer camp where my friends and I put on a musical with our neighborhood kids. And that was a great way for me to learn about everything that goes into arts administration. We were the directors, we were the designers, we were the contractors, we were everything. We contacted local schools and rented out their theater spaces and contacted our friends in the community, local teachers to come out and help us. And these kids paid a very cheap amount to be in the summer camp for 3 weeks where they would all accumulate in a production. And when we saw what light it brought into the kids, that was so inspiring. But then also, every performance we did, we had a sold-out audience of over 100 people. To see our community members not only get behind us, but get behind the kids and the mission of our organization, they wanted it there. And they saw how important arts is to the community, as in, like, young adults, but also, like, in the kids themselves. I decided I wanted to study arts administration and not pursue performance. And while my parents would have loved and supported me whatever I did, I think they were very relieved that I wanted to go into arts administration. And that's what I studied in college. I was a musical theater major with minors in arts administration, music, and education. And I knew what I wanted to do was work in education in the arts. And finding this position was, like, amazing because it includes everything that I wanted to do and so much more, and I get to be a part of it, and I love it. It's so special.
So what was the big moment in your life when it hit you? Were you in a show as a kid? When did art make its impact on you that gave you the fuel to want to then pursue administration and start to hand this on to the next round of kids?
The first show I was in was Willy Wonka the Musical. I was Grandpa George.
Nice.
And I thought it was the coolest thing ever. The next show I was in, I was Cinderella. I was the cat. And I was all these, like, smaller, more insignificant roles, but I was a part of the
community. Very few people can say they were the grandpa in Willy Wonka and the cat, though. I mean, you might not want to keep that one secret.
No, those have since made it off of the resume.
Move them back up.
I'll bring them back on. Yeah.
Like, being part of that, I felt so special, and that ignited, like, that passion for arts and performing, but also being part of it with my friends. And that was just, I mean, I still remember that third grade, fourth grade performances with those friends. Those are very fond memories for me.
So were you shy or uncertain before that and this let you flower, and or this was just a way that your flower got to be shown?
Oh, for sure. I was a very reserved kid and I still consider myself to be more of an introverted person. But when I found the group of friends and performing, I became like a blossom. Like, I was just so extroverted and I had this smaller group. Even at school, I was pretty quiet, but when I would go to my community theater after school, that's where my friends were, and
right,
that's where I was able to be myself and work with everybody else. And when I saw my theater friends at school, I felt like I was, like, a part of it.
Heck yeah. The collaborative inclusion thing is a huge backbone here, and I really, really love that. I appreciate that. That's a great thing. Well, let's get you guys out of here on something fun, something easy, maybe not. What do you see as your next big fun thing you're doing? Do you got a show? Is it just getting a new group of kids in? What's the most rewarding thing on the horizon for you?
Well, we have our summer camp coming around the corner in June, and I think it's always exciting to put it together.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we were doing The Hobbit, so part of summer camp will be about Hobbit, even though we don't perform in summer camp, right? But right. like Martha said...
We do have a performance, a demonstration at the end, but we're not performing
friends, yeah.
the whole... Mm-hmm. production.
Right, yeah. right.
Yeah. But, you know...
That'd be a heck of a 3 weeks.
yeah.
But because summer camp is very different, because it goes through all these different classes and we bring different teachers together and we get a lot of kids that have never been in youth opera and that's their first exposure to it. I think that's a very fun thing that we do in the summer.
Rewarding. Yeah, you know?
To really see the spark of curiosity and excitement
so cool.
turn on. Yeah.
And I mean, I still play piano and I do a lot of chamber music in the community. So I have a few concerts coming around in April and May that it's always fun to put together, you know, with different musicians from the orchestra. So that's fun to me as well. And I have a new niece, my sister has a daughter, so I haven't met her yet, so I need to go to Brazil and
awesome.
Meet my niece, Maria Helena. So.
And share that musical gift.
Yeah.
All right, Cameron, your turn. What's the most enthusiastic thing you got on the horizon for you as it relates to the opera world?
Well, summer camp is my deal. That's one of the big things I do. So recently I've started kicking that up a notch, and when I started last year, I was a little bit, as Martha described, shell-shocked.
That's round one.
Well, it's a huge undertaking.
It's an undertaking, and it, like, it's a lot of kids, and everyone relies on
Well, and some summer camps are a little bit glorified babysitting.
True.
You know, which is not.
I've raised three kids, I can attest to that.
That's not what we do. The kids are involved. We say it's so much more than just singing because they are literally learning everything that goes into opera. So that is my focus for the next few months. And it's honestly one of my favorite parts of this job and this position because it's just so fun.
So yeah, at the end of that, do you feel like, oh my God, I survived? Or at the end of that, do you feel like energized, we did it?
We have a month between end of summer camp and start of The Hobbit. So that month will be a lot of emotions, a lot of catching up, and then just get ready to hit the ground running because this is a year-round program. We don't stop.
Very cool.
We really don't.
All right, Martha, it's your turn. What's the big rewarding thing on the horizon you're looking forward to?
Well, you know, just tying into a question you asked earlier. So I come from a family of nine girls.
Oh, dang.
And grew up in Aylmer, Quebec.
And you all survived?
We all survived. So Aylmer, Quebec, where there was really no arts. That's why it was me and my guitar. So I would have eaten up a program like this. I would have loved something that we offer where it's so inspiring and freeing and creative and collaborative, you know, to be able to share my love of music with other kids would have been just so rewarding. So summer camp, watching the light come on in kids' eyes for how fun this can be. And then again, when we get new kids in the fall and putting the show together, and, you know, it goes from a sort of chaotic place of insecurity to seeing 80 kids on stage, owning that stage.
How rewarding.
It's really rewarding, and it's a challenge, you know, but we've got a really good team for putting that together. So I'm really excited about both of those things, about, you know, the opportunity to share opera in those two ways with kids in the community, summer camp and The Hobbit. I'm really excited.
Very
cool.
Oh,
and something we didn't mention, you know, another preconceived idea about opera, or even like studying an instrument and all of that, is the cost associated with it, right?
Right.
And I think opera is an easy entryway because you don't have to buy an instrument. And luckily, at Sarasota Opera, we have a group of dedicated donors who are making sure that if you want to join and you can't afford it, we will scholarship, you know, we'll give you financial assistance.
Yeah, huge respect out to that community.
Yes.
To be able to do that, you know. So I think, you know, if you're curious about it, don't be afraid to give us a call, send us an email, and we'll work with you.
Amen. That should be your tagline. If you're curious, don't be afraid. Yeah. That's a good one right there.
We might use it.
That's a good one. Well, I appreciate you guys coming down. I'm very grateful to have heard from you. And that line, we're going to run with that one. If you're curious, don't be afraid.
I love it.
Jesse, Cameron, Martha, thank you so much for coming down.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, I look forward to coming and seeing one of your performances.
So I look forward to seeing you at the opera.
And bring your children.
And I'm coming with him. Thank you.